From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Back in the 80s, the Church of Scientology wanted to know what kinds of information the federal government was collecting on it. And so the church did what journalists do all the time. It filed a request under the Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, which requires government agencies to provide an initial response within 20 days. That was in 1987. As of this week, the State Department still has not answered the church's request. It's the oldest outstanding FOIA request, but hardly the only one. This week, just in time for the 40th anniversary of the Act's implementation, the watchdog group National Security Archive released a survey of government responsiveness under FOIA. It found that 53 of 57 government agencies have huge backlogs of unfulfilled FOIA requests. Meredith Fuchs is general counsel at the National Security Archive, and she joins us now. Meredith, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Is there one federal agency that's the biggest culprit that's withholding the most material?
Well, the type of requests vary significantly by agency. And so what we've seen typically is the oldest requests are at the CIA, the Department of Defense, the Department of State. The ones that do have harder requests to process because they often might have classified information in them.
By and large, of the requests that are being sat on, can the government make a good claim that they cannot dare divulge the information that's being requested?
I don't think that's the case. While there are some that have sensitive information in them, there's also situations where agencies simply are not handling these requests. For example, my organization alone has gotten 40-some-odd letters from the Treasury Department indicating that our FOIA requests were destroyed in error and were never processed. Also, under a memo that was issued by Attorney General Ashcroft at the Justice Department, it was issued in 2001, and it basically instructed agencies to withhold if they have any possible basis for withholding. That differed from the policy of the prior Attorney General, Janet Reno, which basically said that agencies should disclose unless there was a foreseeable harm from disclosure.
Yeah, in her piece on the subject, Deborah Howell of the Washington Post talked about a FOIA request for a government press release. They fulfilled the request, but the press release came redacted. Portions were covered in black. Now, this was not a classified document. It was a press release.
Well, that's what I'm saying about the reflexive secrecy. I mean, people look at these things and sometimes they just don't think, and they see something that might be a name that looks sensitive or a country that we have a current sensitivity with, and they just black it out. In fact, we have documents that we received under FOIA a decade ago that if we requested them today, they would come completely blacked out.
Well, speaking of the Justice Department, it's right in the thick of the debate on a legislative fix to FOIA called the Open Government Act, which passed in the House, but which is being held up in the Senate because one senator acting on behalf of justice has put a procedural hold on the bill. Can you tell me about the situation that's going on there with Senator Kyle from Arizona?
Well, it's sort of remarkable that an open government law was being held up by a secret hold. But thanks to efforts of many journalists across the country, we figured out that it was Senator Kyle. And he has some reasons why he's concerned about the bill. But until now, my impression is that he hasn't been very open to trying to reach a compromise. One of his main concerns was that agencies would lose their opportunity to withhold records if they were too slow in responding. But that's been changed now by a manager's amendment that was introduced by Senators Leahy and Cornyn, the co-sponsors. I think that all of Congress, Democrats and Republicans alike, realize that the public is fed up with the administration's resistance to being accountable.
Do you think that the backlash will cause Senator Kyle to back off and the Justice Department as well?
Well, it definitely seems like reforms come after controversies like the ones we see today. You know, in 1974, the Congress passed FOIA reforms and President Ford vetoed them, and Congress overrode that veto. Which is just a remarkable story because I think it shows that Congress can actually push back against an administration that wants to keep things secret and can let the public know that Congress is watching out for their interest.
Meredith, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Meredith Fuchs is general counsel for the National Security Archive, an independent research institute in Washington, D.C.
July 4th is Liberation Day in Rwanda. It marks the day 13 years ago when Rwanda's genocidal government was routed from the capital, Kigali. Also 13 years ago, Rwandan radio station RTLM went off the air. Its broadcasts helped to orchestrate a campaign of mass murder that left hundreds of thousands dead. As a result, after the Tutsi rebel army took control in Rwanda, it banned private radio stations for over a decade. Today, that nation's new broadcasters are still trying to overcome the legacy of RTLM. You can hear that effort every Wednesday and Friday night when Rwanda's airwaves broadcast a different message, one of reconciliation in the form of a radio soap opera. Michael Cavanaugh reports from Rwanda.
It's Friday night, and all across Rwanda's hills, people have gathered around their radios, waiting for the first few notes of a song that just about any Rwandan can hum. It's the theme to Musekeweya, Rwanda's wildly popular radio soap opera. At a small shop in a crowded Kigali neighborhood, about a dozen people have come by to drink sodas and beers and tune into this week's episode. Essentially, Musekeweya is like a Rwandan version of Romeo and Juliet. Two young lovers, Shema and Batamuliza, want to get married, but they come from two different villages whose residents are sworn enemies. Each week, Batamuliza and Shema encounter new obstacles to their love. Fires, thefts, murders. Tensions between the two villages are always on the verge of exploding into mass violence. And through it all, Batamuliza and Shema struggle to unify the two sides. According to the organization that broadcasts Musekeweya, almost 80% of Rwandans tune into the show. That's about 6 million people. At the shop, a 12-year-old boy named Eric says he can name every character. There are about 30 of them. He goes through the list while he twirls a pack of cigarettes that he swears he just bought for his older brother. Everyone laughs when Eric says his favorite character is Gyaima, Musekeweya's town fool. Early one morning at Musekeweya's homemade studios in a wealthy Kigali neighborhood, the show's producers run through a sound check. The concept for Musekeweya grew out of theories developed by two American psychologists about the origins of mass violence. By understanding how violence starts, the theory goes, people will understand how to avoid it and can begin the work of reconciling their differences. Johan de Flander oversees the production of Musekeweya for the Dutch organization that funds it, La Benevolencia.
We're not talking about getting people a psychology degree, not at all. It's just like, what are the basic things you could do to help people out in your own community, which is extremely important, because if there's something that people lost during and after the genocide in this country, it's trust, of course, among people.
To make their point, the show's writers, all Rwandan, decided to create a scenario that was similar to the situation leading up to the genocide, but not so similar that it got them into trouble. Charles Rukundo is Musekeweya's head writer.
You have to think, if we're going to say something related to the genocide, how are people going to react? So we try to give doses of our medicine bit by bit, but we have to do it slowly.
The Tutsi-led government of Rwanda values stability over freedom of speech. Journalists and politicians who've challenged the government's interpretation of the genocide, or who've suggested that Hutus lack a voice in Rwanda's one-party state, have routinely been jailed or exiled. This makes writing a show like Musekeweya particularly delicate. In fact, the writers never use the words Hutu or Tutsi, or even the word genocide. But the symbolism in Musekeweya is clear.
If you compare the two villages, compare Muhumuro as Hutus and Bumanzi as Tutsis.
Eric Sabahungu is one of Musekeweya's stars. He plays the role of Samvura, the peacemaker. He himself is a genocide survivor.
I lost my father and my sister in the genocide. I think of them always, you know. I'm very sad that I'm an actor now, but my father is not there to see that. But I feel proud, and I know that if my father sees me, he'll do encourage me.
Later in the morning, inside the recording booth, the cast shuffles through their scripts and rehearses a song for an upcoming episode. They are a mix of Hutu and Tutsi, young and old. Almost all of them lost family and friends during the genocide or in the wars that followed. Monique Wingabia, the woman who plays Batamaliza, leads the singing. The verse goes, "We're asking God to give us insight to overcome hatred and let peace prevail among all people." It's kind of like a Rwandan version of "We Shall Overcome." In this episode, one village is preparing for an attack on the other village. When a group of youth from both villages finds out, they organize a peace march. But the local security forces interrupt their singing and chanting with volleys of smoke grenades and arrests. It's a lesson in courage in the face of authorities who use violence and fear to manipulate their citizens. How successful can Musekeweya be at teaching these lessons? It is, after all, only a radio show. But as all Rwandans know, the power of radio is greater than most people could imagine. Again, Musekeweya's head writer, Charles Rukunda.
RTLM was a radio station that was used to destroy, and now we're using radio to rebuild. And I think the show is a success because we're doing this in a neutral way. No one says, "Oh, Musekeweya is for Tutsis or Hutus." It's for everyone, and everyone likes it.
Back at the store in Kigali, this week's episode comes to an end. As the theme music plays, one man says that he's impatient for Shema, who represents a Tutsi man, to finally marry Batamaliza, the Hutu love interest. As the people head home, they'll walk along the streets of what has become one of the safest countries in Africa. But there's still deep distrust between Tutsis and Hutus, and as long as the government muzzles the press and exiles any opposition, it's left to fictional dramas like Musekeweya to let Rwandans talk about the distrust that still divides them without directly talking about it. For On the Media, I'm Michael Kavanagh.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Hi there, this is Katia Rogers, senior producer of On the Media. We get lots of emails each week, but can only read a few on air, and sometimes none at all. But we love hearing what you think. And now you can leave comments for us on our website. Tell us what you think of a segment, respond to other comments, and ask questions. Just go to onthemedia.org and click on the comment icon below each segment.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone, with a couple of your letters. Comments, actually, posted to our website at onthemedia.org. On our interview with Arlen Andrews about science fiction writers asked to future cast by the Department of Homeland Security, Stephen Maggie of Austin, Texas writes, quote, "I don't mind the government fishing for opinions from many fields, but they might want to be more balanced with the politics of the sci-fi authors they choose. Come on, Jerry Pournelle? That guy practically wants a military coup to happen in the U.S. OTM also seems to overlook how Larry Niven helped Reagan practically bankrupt the country on Star Wars, as it was called. Many of these things being pitched aren't terribly new. Sure, the government, especially this administration, can lack imagination as it's mired in current problems, but sci-fi writers don't exactly have a monopoly on good or bad future scenarios." But Mark Green of Trabuco Canyon, California, says he takes issue with Mr. Maggie's comments, quote, "The whole point is to look ahead. Future scenarios, suggestions, and supporting arguments should be examined, not immediately dismissed for political bias. I don't care about someone's politics. I want ideas that will work." Keep those comments coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org or publish them right on the website at onthemedia.org. And we really appreciate if you tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name.
In these days of climate consciousness, touting a close friendship with the environment has become an increasingly popular advertising strategy. Claims of environmental responsibility, responsiveness, and concern have brought a green tinge to even the most unlikely products. And because the Earth remains largely silent, the truth of these eco-claims are sometimes hard to check. There have been a few brave souls who've legally challenged the veracity of ads, but the lifespan of an advertisement and the challenge of suing corporations ensure that few succeed. John Stauber, executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy, says this leaves corporations like British Petroleum free to wrap themselves in green.
They've spent minimally tens of millions, if you added up all their advertising, a lot more than that, trying to convince the public that BP really stands for Beyond Petroleum. The reality is that BP is one of the world's very largest, perhaps the largest right now, oil company. They've had some horrific oil spills because they haven't been maintaining their pipelines well in Alaska. And when push comes to shove, this is just a marketing campaign. The more egregious the business or industry, the more egregious the example. When we're talking about the automobile industry, the petroleum industry, the chemical industry, the mining industry, the logging industry, of course, these are industries that have horrific environmental impacts. Now these companies are trying to convince us that they're going to solve the problem, but they haven't changed in any fundamental way. They're still lobbying to forestall regulations, and they're launching ad campaigns.
How are we supposed to judge whether someone is telling a legitimate environmental story in their advertising or PR and when they're spreading disinformation, greenwashing?
Well, I think the public becomes very dependent on journalists. When public consciousness about environmentalism seemed low, organizations like Society of Environmental Journalists were reporting that news directors and editors weren't showing much interest in running stories investigating environmental issues. So it becomes a little of a chicken and an egg situation here. The other protection the public has are environmental organizations. But industry has also learned how to pump money into environmental organizations. So today, when I picked up my New York Times, there was a full-page ad from the World Wildlife Fund and Coca-Cola telling me what a good global citizen Coca-Cola has become because it's given $20 million to the World Wildlife Fund. It becomes very difficult to trust the watchdogs when the watchdogs are being fed nice steaks by the burglars.
If someone makes an advertising claim that's competitive and false, the competitor tends to drag them into federal court and things get litigated there pretty quickly. But other than that, all we can depend on is something called the National Advertising Division of the Council for Better Business Bureaus. Can you tell me the recent history of environmental claims processed by NAD?
The Better Business Bureau for decades and decades has been part of the movement to lift regulations off of industry and get businesses behaving better through something called self-regulation and voluntary regulation. Not too long ago, the nuclear energy industry was taken into this process because they were making claims that nuclear power is a completely clean energy. They were ruled against in this process, but it really hasn't even slowed them down. I mean, this is the problem with anything that's voluntary. You either have regulations and people and companies are held to them, or you don't.
Over the past 10 years or so, news organizations have gotten pretty good at truth-squatting political advertising. I gather you think the press has not done such a good job truth-squatting environmental claims.
The press has done a lousy job of truth-squatting environmentally friendly claims. And I think there's a reason for this. You know, if you look at the business of political advertising, those hundreds of millions of dollars that are being raised for the next presidential election are mostly going into TV media. And if candidate Y isn't spending the money, candidate Z is going to be spending the money. It's a little safer, frankly, for commercial news media to analyze advertisements from political campaigns. But when they start really analyzing advertisements from commercial advertisers, then they're risking their bottom line.
you're charging here that news organizations are protecting their company's advertising revenue by not being more vigilant about environmental-themed ads?
Yes.
That's quite a charge.
Well, I'm happy to make it. I really can't think of any other reason why they don't take a hard approach to critiquing claims made by advertisers other than that they think it would come back to hurt them financially.
Okay, John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
John Stauber is the executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy.
What do global warming and secondhand smoke have in common? George Monbiot, a professor at Oxford University and columnist for The Guardian, explains in his book Heat that in the early 90s, tobacco companies worked with global warming skeptics to challenge new findings on secondhand smoke by launching a campaign to discredit these scientific studies on global warming.
But they realized that if passive smoking was the only thing they campaigned on, their fingerprints would be all over it. So they were advised not to campaign only on passive smoking, but to link it with other issues which bore on regulatory matters. And the first of those issues was global warming.
What's the evidence that you have to document this campaign?
The great thing about one of the big lawsuits against the tobacco companies is that one of the outcomes was to force the companies to put their archives on public record. And so you can go through the source material documenting exactly what their strategy is. And in this case, they say, we're going to set up this so-called grassroots coalition. We are going to call it the Advancement for Sound Science Coalition. We're going to tell it to campaign against junk science, which is any science we don't like, and to campaign in favor of sound science, which is any science we do like.
Now, you describe what we call AstroTurf, fake grassroots campaigns. Mm. So what do they do beyond AstroTurf?
There's a document which says we should launch this away from the big media outlets because they're quite likely to smell a rat, whereas elsewhere where journalists are assumed to be more naive, we think we'll be able to pass this off okay. It was a cleverly run campaign. Unfortunately, journalists right across the US were far too credulous, and the messages were picked up by many US politicians as well as by the public.
These PR firms and the grassroots organizations and the think tanks repeating the line of this Philip Morris coordinated campaign, they weren't necessarily lying, were they? You write that they might just have been selecting and highlighting the research that suited them.
The great majority of what they did was selection rather than invention. And they would cherry pick research results completely out of context and suggest that these research results showed that climate change wasn't happening, or indeed that passive smoking didn't cause any adverse health effects. Whereas if you look at the science as a whole, it showed a very clear pattern of climate change and a clear pattern of adverse health effects caused as a result of secondhand smoke. But in some instances, they did circulate information which was just plain wrong and which had no source.
Well, if the goal was to muddy the waters for the issue of passive smoking by muddying the waters on global warming, did it work?
Certainly, the muddying of the waters on global warming has been extremely successful, and I would suggest that it's been more successful than the muddying of the waters on passive smoking, because certainly in the US, more authorities have taken action on passive smoking than they have on climate change.
You aren't suggesting by your article, though, that Philip Morris took charge on muddying the waters on global warming, do you? I mean, certainly Exxon and the other big oil companies had a fair hand in all of that.
Well, that's absolutely true. But the point here is that one of the campaigns which was by far and away the most central to corporate-funded climate change denial, the Advancement for Sound Science Coalition and JunkScience.com and the other things that it spawned, was actually started by Philip Morris rather than by Exxon, and Exxon only came in later.
When you look at how the media have tried to deal with the situation of, say, global warming. We've noted quite a lot in this program that a false equivalency has been injected into the argument, the sense that there are some scientists that think one thing and some scientists think another, and you've got the appearance of balance when, in fact, most scientists think one thing and only a very few scientists think the other. Are we still dealing right now, do you think, with this false equivalency when it comes to discussing global warming, or have we finally gotten over it and accepted that there is a consensus on the issue?
While there is no substantive debate taking place among scientists about whether man-made climate change is happening or about whether it represents a very serious threat to many of the world's people, in the media that debate is still going on. What it reflects is this very concerted effort by corporations to cast doubt on the science.
George, thank you very much.
That's my pleasure. No trouble.
George Monbiot is a professor at Oxford University and columnist for The Guardian. His new book, called Heat, is available on Amazon.com.
Today on Forecast Earth.
This year, when the Weather Channel celebrated its 25th anniversary with a roundup of the 100 biggest weather moments, global warming came in at number one. Now, one of cable's last privately owned channels is training its meteorologists to work long-term climate change into its short-term forecasts.
Hello, and welcome to Forecast Earth, the first weekly series to examine the science of global warming and how it impacts you.
In 2003, largely in response to Katrina, the network hired climate expert and science advocate Dr. Heidi Cullen to spearhead a new weekly program, Forecast Earth, the first weekly TV series devoted to climate change. Cullen has featured such guests as Al Gore, Dr. James Hansen of NASA, Andrew Revkin of the New York Times, Ted Turner, and Sir Richard Branson. In an attempt to bridge the gap between science and weather, she sees going green as a new direction for network programming on both national and local meteorological fronts. Heidi, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
When you were first hired at the Weather Channel, what was the mandate?
Well, the mandate was really to start talking about climate, and that meant anything from droughts and El Niños to global warming. And 4 years ago when I started, you know, there wasn't a whole lot to work from because there wasn't a whole lot of ongoing global warming coverage at the time. So, you know, we've really been trying to figure out how to cover it as a breaking weather story, so to speak. And it's not always easy.
Is there even scientific consensus at this point that warming temperatures worldwide are actually affecting the weather itself? You know, for example, incidents of hurricanes in the South Atlantic?
The hurricane part is still very much a work in progress. The IPCC report, which came out this year, did state clearly, though, that, you know, long-term drought has increased, that we've seen an increase in extreme precipitation events, an increase in extreme heat events. Meteorologists have an opportunity, you know, when a heat wave pops up to say, you know, this heat wave is consistent with what models project for the future. Models project that heat waves will become more long-lasting, more intense, and more frequent. And so you can make a statement as to whether, you know, a current weather event is consistent with what we expect from global warming.
Now, you say that meteorologists often have the opportunity to discuss climate change, but you have also created quite a stink in the past by suggesting that they also have the obligation to make those connections. You said publicly that you believe that the American Meteorological Society should have to certify that a meteorologist has at least fundamental climate change training in order to stand up there and say whether it's likely to rain tomorrow.
You get questions so much more now than you used to. And I think a lot of meteorologists, you know, they get asked the question, you know, is this heat wave? Is it global warming? And they haven't really had the chance. They haven't been given the time to do the background reading and get up to speed on the state of the science. And I thought that the AMS was a good forum with which to start this process of education because, you know, meteorologists represent the scientists that the American public is most in contact with.
Now, I want to ask you about that because while climate change is an interesting scientific issue, it's also become a political issue. Do you get flamed with emails by people accusing you of being, you know, a tool of the tree huggers and the left wing?
Yeah. You know, it was funny because the first time somebody called me a tree hugger, I was a little bit hurt, you know. And, you know, I didn't want to be seen as an advocate. I wanted to be seen as a scientist who was bringing just, you know, the facts on global warming. And it was funny because after Katrina hit, I think I began to realize that, you know, there's a responsibility, even as a scientist, to give the facts, but also to express my concern. You know, Abraham Lincoln created the National Academy of Sciences to inform policymakers. So the scientists give you the facts and then the policymakers take it from there. Well, I don't think that it's enough to just give the facts. I think you've also got to associate a level of concern with it.
Has there been any backlash from viewers or advertisers?
Well, you know, our viewership, the Weather Channel viewership, we're national, we're available in about 90 million homes, and, you know, we really speak to a very mainstream audience. You know, I get plenty of people telling me that my science is just politics. I mean, at the same time, over the past year, I mean, the number of networks now who've decided to do green coverage is really, it's astounding, and I'm really curious to see, you know, what it's going to look like when all of these other different networks start to cover it.
Well, Heidi, I very much appreciate your spending the time with us.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks very much.
Climatologist Dr. Heidi Cullen is the host of the Weather Channel's Forecast Earth.
Coming up, two how-tos. How to get a good quote from a hungover rock star.
And how to get that shirtless guy on Cops to sign a release form.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, at macfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Back in 1989, when the concept of the reality show was but a twinkle in Mark Burnett's eye, the Fox show Cops was already on the streets, busting criminals on camera. The Fox Cops show spawned a heap of copycat cops because apparently we just can't get enough of the humiliation of shirtless wrongdoers.
North Carolina, 1994. Officers find themselves against an enraged man with a shotgun.
I don't get the damn hell away, sir.
It's a delicate matter, but one the police are equipped to handle.
The show is called World's Wildest Police Videos. The image is a shotgun-wielding man, shirtless on his porch, raving at police. He has gotten himself stinking blotto. He has done violence in his household. Now he is making terrorist threats and a total jackass of himself for all his neighbors and a few million others to see. Renee Less can scarcely believe her good fortune.
He's just this big, fat guy on his porch raving with an enormous gun, and they're all shirtless. None of them are wearing shirts.
She is lucky because in addition to having no shirts, the shotgun-wielding porch stander honors of this nation also have no shame. This man signed a release permitting World's Wildest Police Videos to broadcast his image. And the owner of most every other unobscured face you see on these gritty police reality shows has done the same thing. Lesk is in charge of obtaining these releases. She is awash in 8x11 forms, ready to be stuffed into dozens and dozens of thick vinyl binders.
There's an alternate paper universe that agrees with the visual universe that you look at every day.
But why? Why let some TV producer trade in your personal humiliation? Fred Heilbrunn, a permissions specialist who has obtained nearly 10,000 releases for such shows as True Stories of the Highway Patrol, offers a number of explanations, from malignant macho to civic mindedness to, every so often, cash money. But it is still hard for him to believe how easy it is. Once, he says, he was with a camera crew at a heroin bust, and one of the suspects bolted directly toward them.
The cameraman, who was built like a halfback, steps out. The suspect falls backward into a wall, And the cameraman sticks the camera in this fella's face. And then the cameraman follows it up by saying, "Don't move or I'll shoot you." And the fella threw his hands up in the air and complied like the cameraman had an MP5 pointed at the guy's head. It was just amazing.
Did you approach him to sign a release?
Oh, yeah. And he signed.
To Renee Lesk, the stop or I'll shoot gambit suggests another possibility for suspects' willingness to sign on the dotted line, the confusion over who is a cop and who isn't, and maybe the hope that cooperation with the camera crew will yield softer treatment from the police down the line. Fred Heilbrunn says cultivating that confusion is unethical, and often enough, he says, an opposite force may be at work.
They found out that when the police come through your door, you know, knock it off its hinges, come barreling through, throw you into the wall, handcuff you, and then somebody walks up and says, "Hi, my name's Fred. Has anybody told you what the cameras are about?" The people relaxed.
Bad cop, good producer.
Yeah. You know, I have to admit, I learned some of my techniques from watching the police work.
One thing that all release getters quickly learn is that the culture of reality television, and the culture in general, work in their favor. In this society, appearing on television is deemed an achievement in its own right, and neither the subjects nor the audience seem to be all that concerned about how that is achieved. You know, "Hey, Tony, I saw you on TV. Was that your shotgun? What happened to your shirt?"
I think my favorite was a fella who, to pay off a debt to a dealer, offered his barn to be set up as a meth lab. The way the police found out about him was his electric bill, which should have been perhaps $150 a month, was something like $10,000 a month, and he wasn't paying it.
As police raided the barn, the guy quickly grabbed a guitar and started singing.
When I told him what I wanted, he said, "Will you show me singing?" And I said, "If you'd like." And he signed the release.
No matter that he faced 20 years in prison.
He wanted to be sure that he was going to have at least 10 seconds of himself singing on a national television show, so we gave that to him.
How was the song?
It was terrible. Just terrible. I think, if I recall, he was doing like Puff the Magic Dragon, and just, Joe, it was just awful.
There's yet another category, the chastened criminal who wants to steer others away from foolish choices. Lesk's biggest coup was getting a release from a woman arrested for DWI who was taped for an hour making sexual advances on the arresting officer.
"I can't help it, but I just know you're good looking.
I appreciate it,
ma'am.
Okay.
You know, so you
feel it,
but
I'm outside.
That was, as they say, this lady's rock bottom, and she was persuaded that making herself a laughingstock on television was an appropriate way to begin her new life of sobriety. But of all the explanations for why Lesk's vinyl binders are so full, maybe the best is the most obvious.
Criminals are stupid.
And the best illustration is a piece of tape aired on her show for which no release was necessary because the suspect's face was not visible.
"We saw a guy walk into a convenience store with a paper bag over his head. No holes. You know, he was obviously having some trouble seeing. And he tried to rob it. And it was so, he seemed so ineffectual because of the paper bag and the no holes, that the clerk didn't really understand that he was seriously trying to rob him and he didn't have a weapon. So the clerk just said, I'm sorry, I don't understand you. And the guy with the bag on his head just walked away. Criminals are stupid. They're criminals because they're stupid. Their stupidity puts them in jail. Their stupidity keeps them in jail. When they get out of jail, their stupidity puts them back in jail. Criminals are stupid."
So what you're suggesting is, if I can read between the lines here, you're suggesting, and don't let me, please, put words in your mouth, that criminals are stupid.
That's what I'm saying.
As for the zeitgeist image of the shirtless ruffian on his porch raving, Lesk says, be not misled. There are no more of these people nowadays, she believes, than there ever were.
I think there are just more cameras. I got to tell you, I think the shirtless guy was raving at the police for our grandparents and our great-grandparents. But now there are cameras to capture it. They look for opportunities to capture it. Now we all see it. And the guy without the shirt doesn't mind. He wants his rants to be heard. He's perfectly happy with that development.
To waste our lives would be a sin. So release me and let me love again.
pleasing your audience can be tough, especially if you have a particularly demanding audience of one. That's the biggest hurdle faced by celebrity interviewers. Rock stars and A-list actors can be impenetrable fortresses. But Jancy Dunn knows how to break down their barricades. As a long-standing Rolling Stone interviewer and erstwhile MTV VJ, she's penned a sort of field manual of tactics for teasing out that crucial quote. It's also a personal memoir, a tribute to New Jersey, and a heap of delicious dish called But Enough About Me, A Jersey Girl's Unlikely Adventures Among the Absurdly Famous. Jancy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
Your opening chapter is called How to Jolly Up a Surly Hungover Band During an Interview. You're meeting them in the morning after a show, and what?
I was both a reporter for Rolling Stone and a VJ on MTV, too, and they would schedule these interviews that I would have with musicians in the morning, which is not musician hour, you know, at 10 a.m. And they would roll in and I would know immediately if it was going to be a disaster because the lead singer would have sunglasses on indoors or they would smell like vomit and I'd know that they'd thrown up outside. That happened a lot. I really did start carrying Tic Tacs. And I had to devise a plan to get them to wake up and give me good quotes. And the system that I devised works 100% of the time, and it is, when they roll in and they can't be bothered. And another thing is that they have to pretend like it doesn't matter to them that they're being interviewed by Rolling Stone or MTV, because that's not very rock,
right?
To act like you're excited, right? So you have to be jaded and take it out on the VJ or the writer. So I would always pay attention to the drummer. I practically sat in his lap and I would roar with laughter at every mild joke that he made, like, wah, ah, ah, you know, and I would ask him about his drumming philosophies. They often have one or two. And
you mentioned one of them. Oh, that's amazing. I never thought of it before, but drumming is a metaphor for life.
I have said that before. I'm not proud, but I have said that before with a big smile on my face. The drummer is puzzled at first, maybe a little suspicious, but then he can't help but blossom under your tender gaze, your hyena-like laughter. And then eventually the rest of the bandmates start jostling because they can't stand it. They're hostile. Then they're eager to give you the quotes about groupies and drugs and anything else that you need. And then, of course, when you've left and you're putting the interview together, you don't use any quotes from the drummer. Come on.
One of my favorite chapters in the book is don't get down with the rhythm and blues people if you're the whitest person in the world.
There's this classic thing at Rolling Stone where there was one staffer that said to Queen Latifah, yo, Queen, where'd you get your bag? And she said, I got it at Bergdorf's. You should always be yourself.
And you mostly were, except with Destiny's Child.
Right. Oh, you led into that smoothly, didn't you, Brooke? You got me. I definitely enhanced my religious faith because when I met up with them, they invoked the Lord in every other sentence. So I started bringing up the Lord too. And suddenly I was Billy Graham and I really went nuts. And when I was a kid, I was dragged to Bible school so I could remember certain verses. And at the end of it, I can remember to my everlasting shame, they were testifying about something. They were talking about how the Lord would provide or the Lord was going to do something. I forget what it was. But they were all holding up their testifying hands and I too held up my hand.
But for the most part, it strikes me that where you went right with most of these people is that you really did stay yourself. You didn't embarrass them by trying to be one of them.
No, no, no. It would be such a mistake to even attempt to pretend. You know, I've interviewed really hardcore rappers and R&B stars. And, you know, at first I tried to be D-O-W-N and it just doesn't work. And when I was myself, I found that they really did respond to me better because you don't have to be exactly alike. The contrast sometimes works. And at the same time, I also didn't do that. I have a funkiness deficiency. You'll have to help me out here. You know, that goes wrong, too. You know, I was just myself. It wasn't always a smash success, but sometimes it did work nicely.
Now, a lot of your interviewing do's and don'ts derive from a keen understanding of human nature. For instance, the power of first impressions or what not to say when you're meeting somebody. So could you give me some examples of classic deadly openers?
Oh, I'm a big fan of yours. Oh, that's a killer. I loved your film. So did 300,000 other people. They've heard it 50 times a day by people who stop them in the street. So I've learned the hard way that anything that starts with the word I, even if it's I didn't kill myself because I listened to your album, their eyes glaze over. They do not care.
Unless you say, I was having sex the first time I heard your album. You said that
yes,
one's okay.
I did. I said that to, I hope my folks aren't listening, but I did say that to Jimmy Page and Robert Plant of Led Zeppelin, and it was in fact true. I won't even name the song. It's too sordid, but, you know, they perked right up. But that was the only time I bent my rule and led off the proceedings with the word I.
So we've talked about the psychology of the host, but what about your psychology, Jancy? I mean, what happens when your editor wants you to ask that question that you would rather die than ask? How do you find the courage or temerity to ask the question that you hate?
Oh, Brooke, if it takes place in a restaurant, which often, of course, it does, I have made the mistake of asking the painful question before the check comes, and if the person freaks out on you, then the wait for the check is long and very tense. So I really do always try to ask at the very end, and I'm not fooling anyone, and I always blame my editor. I really don't want to ask about, you know, that prostitute, but my editor wants to know, what can I say? For instance, Kelly Ripa of Live with Regis and...
Uh-huh.
I had to ask her for Red Book magazine, of all places, if she and her husband used sex toys, and if so, which ones? Can you imagine?
For Red Book?
Red Book? What's that about? And she turned bright lobster red, and she was really embarrassed. I mean, she's kind of an old-fashioned girl. And at least I was by the door when I asked, and I immediately said, oh, thanks a lot. Okay, see you later. Bye. And I ran out of there. Of course, she talked about me the next day on the air. That was mortifying. I did a spit take into my coffee.
Well, then how embarrassed could she have really been?
That's true. I mean, just like me, she was using everything for material. It's all sausage, right? It all goes somewhere.
Now, you faced the situation with Ben Affleck when his breakup with Jennifer Lopez was still raw and you were there to talk about something else, but you had to ask this question.
Well, this was to promote his short-lived movie Jersey Girl, directed by Kevin Smith, and we were putting him on the cover of Rolling Stone, ostensibly because of this movie, but of course it was post-breakup and it was very convenient. And his publicist had said, do not ask about Jennifer Lopez. He is not going to answer. But that's the whole reason I was going out there. So I was extremely nervous. And we met at his office and he was not in a good mood. And usually he is an interviewer's dream. He's very quippy. He's very funny. He really labors to give you that good quote. But he had his arms folded and he was very brittle and he was barking out his answers. And so I said, listen, do you want to talk about the breakup with Jennifer? You know, my editor's making me, you know, I blame the editor again. And he floated a theory that the media were complicit in the breakup. And I said, oh, really? How so? And he said, well, they just absolutely followed our every move and we didn't have a chance, our relationship. I mean, I didn't want to say, but every time you turn around there, they were making out with each other on the red carpet, you know, and she was frying up chicken on the television show. And so I started to sweat because we got in an argument, but I kept saying, you really were participants in this. And he said, that's not true. And I'm going to prove it to you. He grabbed his keys and we hopped into his BMW and he said, let's go get a taco and I'm going to show you what happens. We went to this place called Poquito Mas in Los Angeles. Very good tacos, by the way. And within 3 minutes of me getting my veg burrito, the paparazzi converged.
And he egged them on. He told you to hide your tape recorder.
Mm-hmm.
He hugged you and whispered something funny in your ear so that you would laugh. And those pictures were taken. And when you got back to Rolling Stone.
They were all over the wires the next day. There was a bidding war among the tabloids, and the winning tabloid bought them for $11,000. And what he was whispering in my ear was, you're really stiff. You got to look like you like me, you know, because I was very nervous because his arm was around me. And what was funny is every time that I pretended like I didn't want the photographers to take a picture of me, I would kind of shrink away with my tray of tacos. They were all over me. So it was very telling. And he made his point in a very interesting way.
Doesn't that support the argument that maybe we should not feed this appetite for intimacy that is created by countless articles and stuff?
Absolutely. I mean, I have felt...
Do you hate yourself?
Yeah. Well, I was about to say self-loathing was the term I was going to use. Yes, of course. In my off hours, I certainly don't read any of that stuff. I don't watch any of those television shows. It is truly what I do for a living, and that's it.
But that's the question, you see. You've been able to, in a sense, OD on it. But I still read that stuff.
Do you?
Sure. You had a conversation with Robert Downey. I've never met Robert Downey, but I kind of feel like I know him and I read your conversation.
Well, at this point, I feel like with celebrity journalism that we really are one giant high school and they're the cool kids and everyone on the internet can comment on them, can envy them, despise them, emulate them. So I understand why you feel a familiarity with him.
Public radio is populated almost entirely by the high school nerds, so maybe it's even more intense for that reason.
That makes sense. Well, Rolling Stone, too. I mean, everybody was a card-carrying former nerd, you know, carefully disguised. But mutton chop sideburns can't disguise, you know, the inner nerd.
Jancy, thank you so much.
My absolute pleasure.
Jancy Dunn's book, But Enough About Me, has just been released this week in paperback.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, Mike Volo, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had help from Madeline Ellish and Andrea Ambro. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.